This podcast is brought to you by GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, protecting consumers and supporting the global gem and jewelry trade since 1931 through research, education, and laboratory services.
Welcome to the Rappaport Diamond Podcast, and now your host, Joshua Friedman.
Welcome to the Rappaport Diamond Podcast. I'm Joshua Friedman, Senior Analyst at Rappaport, and on this episode, we were joined by Rory Scheinfeld, Managing Partner of M&B Group, a diamond manufacturer based in Hong Kong. Born in Israel, Rory moved to Hong Kong and talked with me about the latest trends in the Chinese consumer market. We recorded this just at the end of the March Hong Kong Diamond and Jewelry Shows, which is traditionally among the most important events on the year. But with Chinese demand weak, sales and attendance at the diamond area were disappointing. Rory gave his review of the show and whether it's still as important to the global industry as it used to be. Enjoy the episode. So it's great to have you on this podcast, Rory. I'm very excited about this episode. And it's excellent timing because the Hong Kong shows have just finished. You're based in Hong Kong and you were at the shows. So we're hot off the press here. I'm going to ask you about the shows in a second, maybe in a few minutes. But in the meantime, can you tell me about your story in the diamond industry and the story of your company?
I got into the industry by mistake, as weird as it sounds, a complete mistake. I was actually doing my BA in economics in Tel Aviv, managing the meat bar in Tel Aviv, the industry, main people coming and sitting on the bar. I got a lot of job offers during my time in meat bar, but I got back then a really good connection to, today is my partner, back then he was my boss, Mr. Oren Hillel. And one day, just like after a year and a half that, you know, we were like having a good banter over the bar, chasers here and there, good talks. He invited me to his office, the Diamond Exchange. We had, I don't know, half an hour, maybe 45 minutes of conversation, not like a very specific conversation about what's the job going to be like. I went out of a Alon building from the main entrance next to Moshe Aviv building. I was calling my mother and I said, you know what, I'm going to move to night school. I know what I'm going to do with my life. And since then, around 15 years, I'm with him. I started my journey polishing facility on the wheel. We are a manufacturing company, so we're doing like from very cheap to very expensive, $50 per carat polish to a very expensive stone. And I started over there. We were manufacturing a lot of dossiers up to 3 carats. You can compare it to a medium-sized Indian manufacturer of today's in size. And over the years, as the industry changes, we moved into more big stones and important colors. And a few years ago, we started our journey in the retail business and we opened our first shop in Hong Kong. And then we opened our second shop in Singapore. And today we are expanding to Australia. During COVID time, a lot of people use that word vertically integrated. So we are kind of a vertically integrated company doing everything from rough till retail.
Now, you've maintained a presence in Israel as well as Hong Kong, right?
We have offices around the world, not only Hong Kong and Israel, a few other, of course.
And where does most of your polishing happen?
So because we are mainly doing big stones, mainly we are polishing in Israel under our supervision.
Well, Rory, how have all the various types of turbulence that we've seen in Hong Kong over the last few years? There was the protests, I think that was 2019. And obviously then there was COVID and general political uncertainty over that period. And then we've seen the mainland Chinese market has never really recovered. How have all those challenges affected M&B?
You can say that since I arrived to Hong Kong in 2011, not only referring to 2019 onwards, the market in Hong Kong changed a lot. From a place that you could have come with a bag and sell very easily on the table to other dealers in Hong Kong, around, I think, 2014, 2015, the market has changed and the dealers became a little bit weaker. And then everybody started to give memo to the shops. And we know, you know, how the story ends today, mostly memo and a little bit on the table. So Hong Kong changed a lot during the last decade. I think that in 2019, during the protests, people felt a little bit unsafe to come to Hong Kong. And of course, it affected a lot on the trade in Hong Kong. In the end, Hong Kong is kind of the center of the trade in Asia. We don't have GST or VAT or any tax on import and export of goods. So it's very easy to work from Hong Kong, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand, all around Asia, at the end of the day, people are buying in Hong Kong. It's easy. And because people started to feel unsafe in 2019, a lot of this trade around Asia Pacific got hurt, and people tried to find other places where they can buy the goods. And I think Hong Kong is still a center of trade. Taxation-wise, it's very hard to replace it. But because of the protests, a lot of the goods went out of Hong Kong and moved to the US or to Israel or to Dubai or to other markets because, again, less purchases here. So I think it's kind of a chain reaction that in the end, on COVID, we can do a whole episode separate. In the end, what happened that Hong Kong is still a very important city, of course, money-wise, power-wise, Hong Kong is Hong Kong, but it got a little bit less interesting for people to come and try to sell on table and as a destination for sales trip.
So the rules, the corruption rules that the government has had over the years, how has that affected, has that limited demand for high value diamond products?
It's a very sensitive subject because it was never allowed, right? But since Xi Jinping took over the government, he tried to implement anti-corruption rules in order to enhance his power in the Communist Party to implement what he sees the best way. I'm not a professor in China. You know, it's a very, very, very complex system. Of course, what you saw that while you enforce more rules about moving cash around and gifting and so on and so on and so, of course, there is a reduction in the yearly turnover in such kind of diamonds.
Is it socially acceptable still to walk around in the streets, let's say a Chinese city, wearing an extremely expensive watch or an extremely expensive piece of jewelry?
100% yes. I can tell you that part of the magic of this area, it's such a big place and you have so many minorities in this area, but it's still one of the safest places around the world. Really, you can walk with jewelry, with diamonds, with watches, and nothing will happen.
You're talking about Hong Kong or Hong Kong and China?
You can go, you can walk also in China. So of course, in each place, there are parts that you don't want to find yourself in 4 a.m. Walking alone in the dark, but in general.
I'm thinking more whether it's acceptable in the sense that is it seen as too much of a lavish display of wealth to be seen, you know, walking around with very expensive jewelry on and nice of some of the stronger enforcement of corruption laws?
I think this is more connected to COVID than corruption rules. I think that people are still showing off with jewelry and cars and jets and yachts and big brand clothing and bags. Of course, bags is a very big part of showing off. But I think it's more connected to COVID because in the end of the day, COVID really changed how we interact with each other. So before COVID, all around Asia, and I'm not speaking only about China, it was very popular to have like big balls and lavish parties. It was not just in Chinese New Year or on a specific holiday. It could be for a birthday. Someone will close, I don't know, the Four Seasons and invite all of his friends or things like that happened. And I think we are what, 2 years after COVID? We here in Hong Kong felt it, that we are really after COVID only in 2023. Around the world, I would say 2022. But I think that since COVID and that those huge gatherings or demand for big parties, therefore big jewelry sets and necklaces and huge earrings and things like that, it never came back to what it was before COVID. This has a little bit more effect than corruption rules.
Can you assume that that would particularly impact diamonds? Because you know, the sorts of items that people would wear to those big parties, would they be more likely to contain high-value diamonds?
Yes, 100%. Well, you know, even if you use ABC items, and I'm not talking about DFLs in the necklace, at the end of the day, when you need to do like 100-carat necklace, it's not the cheapest. So the whole demand for those lavish sets, the only place around the world that it's still on demand, I feel, at the moment, is in the Middle East. What used to be in China, Indonesia, and Thailand, it's less and less and less and less. And I think it's also a matter of different generations. I can tell you that a lot of the older clients in Thailand that used to buy big capstones or even JK, their kids are buying today DFVS, smaller diamonds, but higher quality. So I think it's a generational thing. You also see our generation wearing like gowns and huge sets and things like that. The fashions changed. So it's COVID, and I think COVID contributed a lot to these changes.
We made a video on this actually about a month ago, and the conclusion we came to there was a shift, at least in the mainland, last year seemed to be towards higher colors and lower clarities, probably because you can see the color more than you can see the clarity.
As you say, usually Asia, it's a VVS market, and people are more inclined to listen and hear about SI goods and VS2 goods that it was less in demand in the past, especially in fancy shapes. We all know that fancy shape, it's an upcoming market, and I think it's closing the gap already with rounds.
Right, okay, so moving on to how the show went. The reports that we heard were fairly negative. In the diamond section, it was pretty slow. The sales were quite slow. Imagine in the gold section, it was a different story. What were your experiences from the show?
Same. The diamond section was not performing amazingly. I have to say that the A-list client did not attend the show. I mainly saw dealers from Israel, US, India, and less, I won't call them end buyers, but the shop owners or dealers that making connections between the privates and the suppliers, and less Asian clients in this show.
Asian in general, as in, you know, including, I mean, buyers from Thailand, the Philippines, all these sorts of places. Was that also down?
In generally, 100% Chinese, but in generally, I saw a little bit less, in the diamond section at least, less Asian buyers and more like dealer-to-dealer insights.
Right. I've been to the show a few times, and it's quite an event, quite an impressive event sometimes. Is that atmosphere still there?
Look, first of all, I think it's the biggest diamond show in the world. I think September is a little bit bigger than March, but still, I think March and September in Hong Kong are the most important exhibition in the world. I don't know if you forget or not, but it's two locations. Yeah. So Asia World Expo and Wan Chai. And in Asia World Expo, you have only loose, well, mainly only loose, and in Wan Chai, mainly only jewelry. Thousands of exhibitors from all around the world, and it's very, very impressive to see it. Generally, in the loose section in Asia World Expo, the mood was not in the sky. You asked me if the wow factor is still there. Yes, all the companies from all around the world, we are all there, we are all exhibiting. Amazing booth, friendly vibe. It's not a matter of sales. It's a matter of we are in a period of time that everybody is thinking with himself what's going to be in the next 5 to 10 years in the diamond industry, where the winds are headed, in what should I invest? Because in the end of the day, we're investing our money in stock. So, you know, there are people investing in real estate and there are people that invest in the NASDAQ, but we're investing in inventory. Without further investment in inventory, we cannot earn money. We all know that, you know, if you buy 10 diamonds, you always sell 3 very quickly, 2 a few months after, and you always get stuck with the 2 last ones, right? And you need to enter new inventory in order to sell those last ones. And it's really like that. So the question is for dealers and manufacturers and shop owners, where we need to put the money, lab-grown or natural, fancy color, far size, small sizes, what should we do? And I think it's a question that everybody asks.
Would you say that the interactions at the show, because there wasn't a lot of demand, it was more networking? Was it more trying to reconnect with these clients that you, so that maybe at the next show you'll be able to sell to them?
So I can tell you that the demand is there. So we're getting a lot of calls all of the time. It's not that the phone lines are quiet. We're getting a lot of demands all of the time. But the rates of success from the call to the end sale are a little bit lower than the years before. I think part of it, except of mood, by the way, is that buyers became a little bit more picky. This is what happens in any industry that feeds the clients for many, many years. The level of excitement also goes up. You know, I remember when I started the diamond exchange 14, 15 years ago, that 3-carat diamond was a big diamond. Like, not a lot of people had 5-carat diamonds in stock. And today, everybody has a 10-carat. Everybody has a 20-carat yellow in stock. So I think the level of excitement and the pickiness of the clients, and it's a lot of factors together that the rates of success from the call that you get, I need X, Y, Z to actually sell something. I think that also affects the rates of selling, not only mood and global economy and so on. So I think it's really also the pickiness of the client. And clients are becoming a little bit more, I don't want to call it smart because our clients are smart, but a little bit more educated with where they want to invest their money, in what kind of item they are feeling more secure to buy and hold. In terms of the show, I think the show is always, look, it really depends in what kind of item. In the 50 points to 2 carats, people are coming to the show and they are buying what they need. When you're talking about the 10 plus, it's always networking because these kind of goods are not moving a lot on the table.
Those consumer trends that we mentioned before about colors and clarities, were they evident at all at the show? And did you see more demand for lower clarities than in the previous shows?
Well, first of all, the India inner market is performing very well in the last couple of years. And this changing a little bit the map of demands, while China also changing. So usually China used to buy a lot of JKS size. I'm talking about the smaller sizes. And now they are looking for the higher colors and higher alternatives. And when the India market is performing so well, they are still looking for the low color and low alternative goods for the big sets and weddings and things like that. There are also clients for the high colors, but mostly low colors, low clarity. So I did not felt like a real change, like globally in the demand map, but in generally lab-grown, of course, changed a lot the demand. I think the only factor that changed the demand in low color, low clarity is not China or India, it's the lab-grown.
This podcast is brought to you by GIA. Consumer trust is vital to the global gem and jewelry industry from mine to market. Through research, education, instrument development, and independent gem grading and identification, GIA is dedicated to protecting consumers, ensuring their trust in gems and jewelry, and helping the industry thrive. Visit gia.edu for more information.
People have more opportunities and more options today what they can buy, so there is less demand naturally for those low clarity, low color, especially in the smaller sizes.
And just two questions there. Firstly, just to rationalize two things that we've said, maybe I misunderstood you before, that you're seeing Chinese consumers showing more interest in SIs?
In higher colors.
You're saying clarities are steady, or what are the trends that you mentioned before?
So usually the big retailers in China, the Chow Tai Fook, Look Fook, all of those companies, they used to buy a lot of JK, SI. We don't see those big demands coming a lot to the market from this part of the world. I see it a little bit more from India, and I see a growing demand from India in our market for those kind of goods. In China, we see less demand for the low color, low clarity, but a steady demand for the higher color and lower clarity. I mean, VS2SI, not I1s.
Right. I wonder if that reflects more the product mix from the consumer side. So the middle and lower income groups are just not buying, whereas the wealthy are still buying, and that might explain a shift in the proportion of goods towards higher quality. Do you agree?
I can tell you that I can speak from experience. I can tell you what's happening in our shops. As you said, people from the middle higher class are still buying, and they are aiming for those better qualities. But people that are struggling, or let's say a younger couple that are just getting married, with the introduction of lab-grown, a lot of these demographics are going into lab-grown instead of going to those low clarity, low colors. So I think this is what happens, that you have those middle higher class buying natural diamonds, and the demand is there, and they are still in the market. There will always be higher colors, let's say medium clarities. I don't see a lot of people going for a VVS today, but usually it's, let's say, SI1 to VS1. The range is there. While the people that used to buy 1 carat KI1, they don't want those low color clarity when they see the lab grown next to it. And I think it's kind of, I won't say canceling the market, but it got a lot of air out of this part of the market towards the lab.
Was there much of a presence of lab grown companies at the show?
Yes.
Was there a pavilion or a hall or something?
So in Asia World Expo, you have a pavilion for loose diamonds lab grown. And in Wanchai, there was a pavilion for entropy.
Did you manage to see if it was busier than the natural section?
You know, it's, I think, tenths of the size. So it's very hard to compare from speaking with people over there. And they were quite busy.
Fine. I just wanted to ask a bit about, we've spoken a bit about Chinese consumer demand, but one of the particular trends that we've seen in Hong Kong is that since the border with mainland China was reopened about a year ago, or just over a year ago, there's been more tourist demand. How has that affected the market and your business?
So we don't see the same demographics of tourists for COVID. There are many campaigns to bring tourists from mainland China to Hong Kong, but it's like, you know, day tours and a few hundreds a day. It's not the high end like we used to see. COVID contribute to the fact that people discovered that they can shop in different places, not only in Hong Kong. I haven't seen those huge line in Canton Road for Hermes or Prada or Louis Vuitton like before COVID.
Right, so before COVID, tourists would come from mainland and spend, what, say, a week in Hong Kong and going around buying jewelry and handbags?
I think the numbers of luxury kind of weekends were higher than today.
Right, right.
In Chinese New Year, the Golden Week was more or less the same than before COVID. But I can tell you that speaking with retailers and restaurant owners, they don't really felt the effect of those numbers.
Right. I had a bit of a reality check recently because I had always assumed that the Chinese New Year was kind of a bit like China's Christmas, where it's the main time of the year that people are buying jewelry. But when I actually looked into it and actually, you know, spoke to people, it's not really for buying jewelry. Maybe when the economy is very good, then people go out and buy. But it's not like in the US in the fourth quarter where everyone's buying gifts and there's a big bump in diamond demand. Do you agree with this?
100% agree. It kind of goes against our logic that in the new year and, you know, such a big holiday, people will not spend on gifting and jewelry. But the main reason for that is very simple. You're getting those red envelopes, right? Licey. And in those red envelopes, there is money. And people are giving a lot of money to each other. And a lot of money goes around the family. So because you're gifting money, and a lot of money, talking about big numbers usually inside the family, people are like not feeling very inclined to buy extra presents for themselves or treat themselves during January because they're actually spending a lot of money on the licey. I can tell you that some of our clients said this year we are going abroad. We are not staying with the money gifting. It's too much. You know, people are like running away from spending the time with the family and actually need to gift a lot of money to each other.
Well, for our listeners who don't see this, they're already showing me a red envelope with a gold symbol on it.
So in Chinese New Year, basically the day after, the tradition is to give the red envelope with the money inside and the blessing Kong He Fa Choi. So a lot of people actually think that Kong He Fa Choi is like Happy New Year. No, it's not Happy New Year. It's I wish you to be rich. That's the blessing when you give the envelope. Don't catch me exactly on the word, but the tradition is that people with kids and families should give the singles. Already beyond that, you give a lot of people around you. I can tell you that I'm giving envelopes to the guards where I live and the cleaners and the people around you that you see all of the year.
So I understand that people feel a bit poor after giving all of this money. But is there a bump after Chinese New Year, from, you know, spending from people who've received gifts?
I think that towards the end of February, we already see that the retail market is going back to the regular self and people are going out and spending and life going back to normal. You know, we have short memory.
Okay, going back to the topic before about the role of Hong Kong, we've touched on this before, but do you think Hong Kong as a trading center and the Hong Kong show as a trading show has waned, have lost importance?
I don't think it's a question of importance because fact-wise, it's a fact that in the end of the day, Hong Kong has the two biggest shows around the world. And even though they tried to do it in Singapore, I think in 2022, in China, in a few places, even JCK, it's not coming to the size, the sheer size of the shows in Hong Kong. So I don't think it's a matter of importance. I think that it's a gateway that people from all around the world, they know that everyone are here, everyone are exhibiting. So we are all enjoying the fact that everyone are here. I don't think it's connected to the importance of Hong Kong as a trading center. I think the sheer size of those shows are a little bit disconnected from the question if Hong Kong is still a trading center or not. I think it's just two most important shows around the world. You can say Miami, you can say JCK, but the sheer size of those shows and how many international exhibitors are coming to Hong Kong versus those shows in the US still makes Hong Kong a more international show. And the US, it's a little bit more like local US shows.
Right. Right.
So I don't think that the shows lost the importance as a global show, a global diamond exhibition. You ask me in generally if I think that shows are necessary or not. That really depends what you do, what kind of items do you have, what are your goals, what you're trying to get from the show, and so on and so on. I think that one thing that's a little bit difficult the two locations and the fact that it's very long. If you want to do it in two locations, it's like 10 days, 8 to 10 days together. That makes it a little bit too much. And I think that for the exhibitors, it's working against us, because in the end of the day, to arrive to Hong Kong for the show, during the show, hotels are expensive, flights are expensive, going out in Hong Kong is not super cheap. So everything is a little bit in pressure, because going to the airport, you know, it's like 45 minutes to the airport and then 45 minutes to the city, and whereas it's a little bit difficult.
Does the Lusa inspection benefit from the fact that it's right by the airport and people can just fly in?
The opposite. I think that if the Lusa was in Wan Chai, there was a better performance than it is today, because the ride to the airport, the 45 minutes, in and out, you need to have, like, when the market is good and you really need to go and you have a lot of demand, the show would perform amazingly. When the market is not doing amazingly, just to walk around and to say hi, okay, I will go a day.
Rory, you're obviously joining us from Hong Kong, and we're in Israel in the basement of the Israel Diamond Exchange. But you were born in Israel and I wasn't, so I want to ask you a bit about, you know, very briefly about the Israeli diamond industry, because it's obviously been through a lot of challenges of different types in the last few years. It's not quite the manufacturing and trading center that it used to be. What's your opinion on this? Where do you see it going?
Oof. There are a lot of challenges and there is always solutions, but I don't think that even if we can succeed to implement all of the solutions, the industry in Israel will go back to the golden years, because, you know, geopolitical changes, I just don't think it will go back to what it was. I'm not saying it de facto, but how it looks that, you know, the India government says we want the diamond business to ourselves. And when you have state-owned banks backing up the diamond industry, the whole industry looks different. We will not go into lab-grown diamonds, yes or no, but the fact that in Israel you cannot send the lab-grown diamond rough into Israel if you don't have a VAT company, you cannot send it through your regular company, working force. And today, I think it's a little bit too late, but if it was implemented 15 or 20 years ago, I think you will have more diamond polishers in Israel than you have now. And this is kind of a pickle, you know. Today, I can tell you that we're very busy in our polishing facilities in Israel, and there is times that we don't have enough working hands. And in the end, a lot of the work is getting delayed in diamond polishing, means a lot of money getting stuck, just because we don't have working hands.
Fundamentally, isn't it just about the cost of labor?
The cost of labor, taxation, it's how the IRS is implementing tax calculation on diamond stock. It's a lot of things that I think it's a little bit too late, especially when today Dubai is doing a lot of effort to move a lot of the industry to Dubai. I don't know if in Israel, especially these times, we have the financial power. The government has the financial power to actually implement steps to get the diamond industry back to its glory days. Because, you know, when I'm arriving to Israel, to the diamond exchange, and I see empty buildings, I think we can do better.
There are ambitions to rent some of the space out and possibly get revenue for the industry.
I don't know if it should be rented to lawyers and accounting firm. I think that there are still a lot of people, professionally related to the industry, can enjoy sitting in the diamond exchange and not around the diamond exchange in outer buildings.
Rory, on that note, thank you very much. I've very much enjoyed your insights and opinions on Hong Kong, on China, on a Hong Kong show, on Israel, and on all these topics that we've covered. I'm very grateful that you joined us on the podcast. Thanks a lot, Rory.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
This podcast is brought to you by GIA, the Gemological Institute of America, protecting consumers and supporting the global gem and jewelry trade since 1931 through research, education, and laboratory services. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Rappaport Diamond Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to get future episodes. For more discussion, news, and analysis about the diamond industry, you can visit rappaport.com, follow Rappaport Group on Instagram, and follow Rappaport on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also invite you to watch our weekly market comment videos on our YouTube channel.